What's up, everybody? This is Eric DeMond, and you are now tuned into the Father Redeemed Podcast. All right, all right. We are back. Episode 2. And so in this episode, what I wanted to do is I wanted to start talking to you about my book entitled Father Redeemed by Eric DeMond. So why did I write the book? Well, it's a long story, but I'll keep it brief. This book has been in my heart for about 9 years now, and it's basically my testimony of being a weekend dad and going through all the different situations and circumstances that you would expect or that you've probably heard that most weekend dads go through after a very painful divorce. I was living in Central Texas from 2006 to about 2016, almost 10 years, early part of 2016. And I had just gone through a pretty painful divorce at the end of 2015. I had 3 young children, and I was trying to figure out what to do with my life post-divorce. So, you know, as you can imagine, I went through the whole process of going from being in the home with my children. At the time, they were ages 8, 6, and 18 months, 2 boys and a girl. The girl was a baby. And so going from that situation, being in the house every day, taking care of my kids, you know, this, all the things you would expect a father to be doing. Then going from that to living in an apartment complex by myself, you know, literally 6 miles down the road from where my children were now staying with their mom. So it started then. You know, I started kind of contemplating, man, this is a pretty traumatic experience. And I know millions of men, millions of fathers go through it, but something about my experience seemed very unique, very traumatizing, and to be frank, very unfair. And I wanted to communicate that. I wanted to share my thoughts on the whole experience. I wanted to voice or give voice to my feelings and emotions at the time. But in all honesty, I wasn't ready. You know, I was just too traumatized, too distraught to do it. So it took me a while to really gather my composure, gather my thoughts. And here we are, you know, 9, almost 10 years later, and I finally found the courage to do it. So in the very beginning of my book, once you guys pick it up, you'll kind of understand what I'm talking about here. But on one of the very first pages of the book, after the table of contents, there's a dedication. And it reads like this. This book is dedicated to the fathers working to stay engaged in their children's lives and to their children who love them for fighting to be in their lives. That's why we're here, fathers. You know, we're here to take care of our kids, to teach them, to guide them, to steward them as God would have us to do, because children are a gift from the Lord and they are our responsibility. You know, we're responsible for them up into a certain point in their lives, up to a certain age, if you will. In westernized civilization, that's typically around the age of 18, before they are declared, you know, adults, or they reach adult status. So from 0 to 18, you know, our job as a father is to raise them, to teach them, to guide them, and show them the things that they need to know and need to be able to do in order to survive in the world, out in the wild, so to speak. If you're, you know, think about it from the perspective of an animal, right? Men are naturally suited for survival. You know, we think about survival. We are hunter gatherers, if you will. Our job is to hunt, to provide for our families, to make it happen, to be problem solvers. And when it comes to our kids, we have to teach them how to do the same thing. You know, most of the time the focus is on boys, you know, raising boys into young men and into capable men who can later become providers for their families. But you know, we also need to be thinking in terms of our daughters, setting the example for our daughters as to what sort of man they need to be looking for later once they become adult women. So we set the standard, men. We set the standard. And without the man, without the father in the lives of their children, our children have no standard. They have no expectations as to how they should act, how they should be treated, and what they need to do in order to survive and to even thrive in this crazy world. After you get past the dedication in my book, what you'll see is on the second page, I've got one of my favorite Bible scriptures from the book of James, James 1, verses 2 through 4. And I'm reading from the New Living Translation. It says, "Dear brothers and sisters, when troubles of any kind come your way, consider it an opportunity for great joy. For you know that when your faith is tested, your endurance has a chance to grow. So let it grow. For when your endurance is fully developed, you will be perfect and complete, needing nothing." That verse is powerful to me. It speaks to me. And quite frankly, I refer to it often whenever I'm going through something. Because the key point, or points, I should say, in those verses is that whenever you run into trouble or are facing adversity, instead of looking at it from a negative perspective and, you know, kind of throwing your hands up and saying, woe is me, or feeling like, oh, why did this happen to me? Look at it as an opportunity. Look at it as an opportunity to solve a problem, to overcome the adversity or the circumstances, and to grow your faith. Because it's during adversity when your faith is really tested and your ability to overcome that challenge and persevere through the storm, so to speak, or through the circumstances, that's what helps you to grow and mature and develop that perseverance and that endurance that's necessary for you to get through life, for you to move forward. So that verse means a lot to me because I've had to deal with a lot of adversity in my life. But, you know, when I went through, you know, my divorce, that had to be probably one of the most traumatic experiences that I've ever gone through. And it really tested my faith. It really tested my faith. And it proved to me that I could persevere, that I could endure. And I can attest to the fact that 10 years later, almost 10 years later now, that I'm a lot stronger than I was back then. My faith is a lot stronger than it was back then. I had to really dig deep and, you know, find the strength to move forward. I've had to persevere. And so that was kind of the pretext for me writing this book. And so, you know, I move into the preface. I give a brief introduction. You know, as we all know, being a father is already challenging. But when you're a weekend dad, it's even more challenging because you don't have access to your kids on a daily basis. You don't have that daily interaction that you would expect a father to have. You're not involved in the day-to-day decisions and the day-to-day teachings and guidance that you would normally have an opportunity to be involved in. And so it can be lonely. It could be discouraging. It can really force you to kind of shut down emotionally because you feel isolated You feel rejected. You feel, you know, discouraged. You feel frustrated. And it almost feels like you're in an echo chamber. All you hear is your voice, because your voice is the only sound bouncing off the walls in your new home or your apartment. Long gone are the sounds of your kids laughing and joking or playing around, playing with their favorite toy or watching their favorite show. You know, when they fall and get hurt, you know, you don't hear those cries. You don't hear those requests. You know, they're tiny little voices requesting things from you. You can't get those hugs that you're accustomed to, that physical touch. And so all of that is gone. And depending on your visitation schedule, depending on, you know, how much access you actually have to your kids, you can go long periods of time without those types of interactions with your kids. And, you know, over time, your heart starts to harden. Your mind naturally tries to make sense of it all and, you know, mitigate the circumstances by blocking out certain things and making those conscious adjustments so that you're not just stuck. And I tell you, the mind is amazing, because the mind is literally built to persevere, if you will, or to adapt. Meaning, when you go through trauma or when you go through a traumatic experience, your mind does its absolute best to blot out or block out the painful aspects of that trauma so that you can function, so that you can survive and move forward. And in doing so, it'll block out certain pieces of information. It'll block certain memories. It'll prioritize certain emotions over others. And if you're not careful, if you're not conscious of it, you can get to a point where you're like a walking zombie, where you really do begin to lose touch and you're not functioning like you normally would, right? And that can manifest in all kinds of forms, right? You know, depression, anger, frustration, agitated, you know, a state of agitation. So there's a number of things that can happen. I'm not a mental health professional, but I will tell you, I have sat down with several mental health professionals in my own efforts to just work through, you know, the circumstances and my feelings and emotions, you know, around those circumstances. But I'll tell you, man, you can really go to a dark place if you don't, you know, recognize what's going on and get some help if need be in processing those circumstances. The other thing is your heart starts to harden, and it hardens towards, you know, your ex, baby mama, whatever you call her, or however you refer to the mother of your children. It starts to harden toward that individual because, you know, you've been rejected. And you now have to make a huge adjustment to the fact that that person is no longer in your life. Everything you've invested in that relationship is pretty much gone. And you have these little bitty humans that the two of you created that you no longer have access to. And your rights are essentially invalid, not only to that other person, but to the court, to the law. You know, depending on what state you live in, you know, the family court system has laws that determine, you know, custody and visitation and access. And I don't care how good of a relationship, how amicable the split was with your ex, there are always going to be barriers and conflict when it comes down to you getting access to your children. So that goes without saying. It's just part of the process, unfortunately. But back to the book, you know, what I tried to do in the introduction is I tried to give you guys, or all my readers, men and women, if you will, a quick synopsis of kind of how we got here, how we got to this place in our society where fatherhood has been minimized. Most homes in America are single parent households, or another term I've heard used is fatherless households. Right now, the statistics show that 61% of the households in America are fatherless, or it's a situation where children are being raised by a single parent. That's crazy if you think about it. 61%, like over half. And depending on, you know, any particular demographics, right, that's not just white, you know, households. That's not just Black or Hispanic, Asian, East Indian, what have you. That's across the board. Now, those numbers are even higher when you start looking into specific demographics, like, for instance, the African-American community. African-American or Black households, that number's higher. It's closer to 70%. Of children being raised in fatherless households. And I got to tell you, you know, the research I did, that lends itself, that statistic in particular lends itself to the reasons why our society is so jacked up today, why the crime rates are higher, why lower education rates are lower, you know, less kids are going to college, less kids are finishing high school, you know, teen pregnancy, higher rates of teen pregnancy when the fathers are not in the home, higher rates of drug use and abuse, higher rates of teenage suicide. All of this can be tied, you know, intrinsically to the fact that more and more of our households in America are fatherless. So it's a big deal. So that being said, why isn't the media covering that? Or why isn't the media at large shining a light on this issue? Well, I'll tell you why. Because it's like the old saying regarding the pharmaceutical industry or the medical industry. The money is in the symptoms. There's no money in the cure. If pharmaceutical companies made drugs that actually cured illnesses and diseases, they couldn't make money. It'd be a one-time sale. But if you just treat the symptoms, if you make drugs specifically to treat the symptoms, people are going to keep getting sick. You're going to keep getting a common cold. You're going to keep getting the flu. You're going to keep getting viral infections. Rather than kill the virus or, you know, give you a pill or a cough syrup that's going to knock that virus completely out, I'd rather treat your cough. I'd rather treat your stuffy nose, your headache, your fever, because it's going to happen again. And the next time you feel those symptoms, I can sell you some more drugs. So I can keep selling you drugs as long as you keep having symptoms, but I'm not going to sell you something or make something that's going to wipe it out completely. The family court system is very similar in that regard. Judges, lawyers, and your ex or the mother of your children all stand to gain financially from divorce, from child support, from any sort of punitive legal actions against fathers. They make money. It's all about the money. And many of us know, child support is a joke. That money is supposed to be for the children, but very rarely do moms or mothers, single mothers, spend that money on the children. Instead, that money goes into mom's budget, and it's used to take care of her needs, which is totally unfair, and it's not right. But the court won't do anything about it. They won't monitor how she spends that money. They're not doing welfare checks to make sure your children have food and clothing, and you know their extracurricular activities are all being taken care of and paid for. They're not worried about whether mom's car is running, if the kids get to school on time, and they're especially not worried about whether or not you see your kids. I recently got reminded of that when I went to court, and the judge asked about my visitation schedule with my children. And mind you, there are times when I am unavailable, whether it's because of work or I'm out of town, or most recently I've been in school trying to better myself. And there were times where I could not do a Wednesday night dinner or pick the kids up on the scheduled on my scheduled weekends, pick them up on the Friday night. I had to pick them up on Saturday morning instead. Well, when the mother of my children tried to make a case that I'm unavailable and that I don't pick up the kids, the judge didn't bat an eye when he stated, well, man, that's not our problem. You know, it's up to him if he wants to see his kids or not. We're not going to enforce that. We're not concerned with that. And I wasn't surprised, but I was just like, wow. So the court could really care less if children have access to their fathers or even see their fathers, or if fathers exercise their visitation rights and spend time with their children. All the court cares about is how much money can we get from this dude? How much money or how much child support can we assign and enforce? In my case, three kids, roughly $1,800 a month. Now, you know damn well it don't take $1,800 a month to take care of three kids. I don't care what, you know, what's going on. I don't care how much they eat. The only way you need that much money to take care of three kids is if all three are in private school, which mine are not, and they need new clothes every month and they don't, or they all have eating disorders. And you got to spend, you know, $500-$600 in groceries every week. And that's not the case. So the child support system is unfair. It's corrupt. They don't give a damn about fathers. And that's part of the reason why so many women in America are getting divorced. I read an article yesterday, matter of fact, that the number one way that women in America get wealthy is through divorce, especially in states where there are they have alimony, you know, as part of, you know, the divorce proceedings. Places like California, New York, big alimony states. So we already know it's expensive to live in those places. But imagine if you're living in one of those states with the tax codes and you're making decent money, right? You've saved, you've invested, you've got a 401k, a retirement savings plan, you've got some personal savings, you got a few assets, you bought a home, you know, a couple of cars, you're living comfortably. But then all of a sudden, you get divorced. And now you got to give up half, if not more, to your ex. And don't let it be a situation where she's a stay-at-home mom or she doesn't work. Well, you've not only got to pay child support for the children that the two of you created, but you got to pay her alimony so that she can maintain her lifestyle. So all that to say, you can lose your shirt. There's a reason why a lot of men go homeless, claim bankruptcy, ruin their credit, and ultimately end up getting criminal records because they cannot fulfill the obligations of paying child support because they can barely afford to survive financially. The other situation is they often have to relocate to find work or to survive because they can't afford to live in those places anymore on one income, where all these monies are being taken out to support their children and, you know, maintain the lifestyle of their former wives or ex-girlfriends. So it's crazy, man. I don't want to belabor that point, but somewhere along the way, somewhere in the last 40 years, really 60 years, I'm sorry, you go 60 years back to the 1960s with some legislation called the Aid to Dependent Children Program. That was enacted at the time because the government was trying to address, you know, single motherhood, you know, and support, you know, single women who were raising kids in situations where the fathers had left, you know, voluntarily. And there was a lot of that happening at the time, believe it or not, 60s and 70s. But, you know, the reasons why are debatable. You know, a lot of times, sometimes it was because of jobs. Sometimes it was because of discrimination. Sometimes it was just because, you know, the two people got together, you know, had a kid, they weren't married, had no intentions of being together, but, you know, they ended up having a kid, you know, irresponsibly, but yet it happened, right? So this Aid to Dependent Children program, initially, it was to help single mothers, single parent households, and it excluded married couples. And that was kind of the beginnings of promoting single parent households and, you know, the very beginnings of kind of undermining the important role that fathers play in the lives of their children, as well as, you know, within the household. So it started there. Shortly after that, you had the Child Support Enforcement Program, which again was intended to support children, you know, of single mothers, but this one went a little bit further. It penalized fathers financially and even further minimized the roles of fathers. So this is the first time where fathers had to start paying child support or paying a sum of money to the mother in order to support the children. And so late 60s time frame, you fast forward to now, and it's only gotten more and more punitive regarding fathers, and the divorce rate is spiked. Back in the 80s, the divorce rate was roughly 19%. Today, as I mentioned earlier, it's 61%. So we've come a long way. You know, the marriage rate has plummeted. The divorce rate has skyrocketed. Child support has become more and more punitive, increasing in the amount per the guidelines set for it by the family court system. Men are starting to avoid marriage altogether because of the potential to get divorced and lose everything, to be penalized for just being a man, for being a father, for having kids. And that's where we are today. That's where we are. So I hope you guys will, I hope I gave a brief, you know, summary of the introduction to the book. The book goes on to talk about, you know, other trends that we're seeing in our society, and it gives, you know, statistical information. It gives supporting evidence of kind of this trend we've seen over the last 60 years where the roles of fathers have been minimized in the home with our society, and how financially debilitating the family court system has made it for fathers to stay engaged in the lives of their children. And it is sad, but I hope you guys will read the book. In episode 3, what we're going to do is we're going to start getting into this acronym that I created called the FATHER acronym, using the words or the letters from the word father, F-A-T-H-E-R. My goal with this book and with the acronym that I created is to help you heal, help you develop the courage, the motivation to stay engaged in the lives of your children, despite all of the things coming against you, despite all the adversity, despite everything that's, the system, basically the system that's been designed to cause you to fail. We have to take a stand as men, as fathers. We have to take our children back. We have to develop that determination, that grit that's necessary to persevere. And in the end, if we persevere, as the verse says, James 1, 2 through 4, our faith will be grown, we will mature, and we will get to a point where we need nothing. We need nothing. We'll be complete as men, as fathers, and our children will be complete because we stayed engaged and we helped them become who they were supposed to be. That's all for now. Hey, guys, I hope to see you in the next episode 3. For now, take care. God bless.